Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
Okay, so today we are joined with Chris Schobinger. Brandon, tell us a little bit about Chris and why he's here with us today.
Well, Chris is the guy who discovered me. Chris is the guy that said yes. Every author is hoping to find a publisher that will want to publish their book. And as I was a brand new author struggling to get anyone's attention, Chris was the first guy, A, to give me some attention, and be the first guy to say yes. Chris is also a polymath, which I just think he is a guy who has some genius level talents in a bunch of different categories. He's very artistic himself. He does a lot of ghostwriting himself. He runs Shadow Mountain. He's the vision behind it, which is the publisher that's published mine and many other books. And he's one of my favorite people. Is Chris Schobinger.
Yeah. And Chris Schobinger actually published one of my board games years and years ago, Feast and Famine. So, I've always been a big, fan of Chris. So Chris, thanks for, joining us here today.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Yeah. Chris, tell me a little bit about Shadow Mountain. I think maybe so it might fly under the radar with Deseret Book a little bit. So what is the purpose of Shadow Mountain and how did that get started?
Yeah, Shadow Mountain is the national arm for Deseret Book Company. So Deseret Book Company is the parent company of Shadow Mountain. We publish books for the national market that are family friendly, morals based, clean content. These are not LDS books. We don't publish for the LDS market. We publish just quality content that we think any family, no matter your denomination, right, would love to share.
Awesome. And how long had Shadow Mountain been around when you first did you help start that arm of it?
So Shadow Mountain was started by Sherry Dew back in the 90s, and I don't remember the exact year, but at the time, she was looking to grow the imprint and invited me to join the publishing division. I had a marketing background. I was working in the marketing department at the time, and she wanted to take my marketing skills into the publishing world to take a product from conception to consumer. Right. And so, yeah, I was thrilled for the opportunity. But she was the brainchild of Shadow Mountain. And then, at some point, we did a survey with, I think, 2000, Deseret Book customers. And we asked them, what was the last book you read from cover to cover? And surprisingly, which I did not expect this, but surprisingly, the number one answer was Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't offering anything fantasy oriented, right? And nothing along the lines of Harry Potter. And so that's when we decided, okay, if we're going to be serious about catering to a national market, let's publish what at least our core audience is reading. And branch out to, to a national market.
That's awesome. And it was early 2000s, I believe, when Brandon submitted his first manuscript to you, which was The Other End of the Hippo. Tell me, when you got that manuscript, what were you expecting? What happened when you saw that manuscript?
Well,
the manuscript that you rejected.
If my memory serves me right, Jason, you actually delivered that manuscript.
Oh, did I?
Yeah. Yeah, you sent that to my office and with the encouragement, right, to that you thought this writer was the real deal and that I should take a look at it. And so I did. I mean, I obviously I don't have time to look at everything that comes across my desk. Usually I will give that to the acquisitions team and they'll look at it, but I have such respect for you and your eye, and so I looked at it. I loved this author's writing, but it didn't feel like what I was looking for exactly. Yeah. And I remember reaching out to you saying, you know, saying something of that matter and like, but I'd love to go to lunch with this author. You know, I'd love to talk about like what else he has in his back pocket.
Yeah. And Brandon, I remember you were writing at the time a short story about a magical preserve and that blossom. Tell me about how that worked with switching gears from Beyonder. Chris was, I remember he gave you some notes for Other End of the Hippo, and instead you're like, nah, I don't want to do these notes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, it's funny. I mean, you and I were working at Excel Entertainment mm-hmm. together, which was why you were being my like agent in this case, kind of like slipping the book to Chris. Let's see.
I remember you, specifically got, if I remember right, there was notes of violence in Beyonders that just didn't fit for what Shadow Mountain was looking for at the time. The fantasy was there. And I think you kind of got notes that said, hey, if you can make these changes, this could be publishable. And you were like, nah, I don't want to make these changes. I like where the book is.
Here's the thing. I couldn't see how to change it. I was too close to the story. And so Chris was like, hey, this can work if it's a younger main character and if we take some of the violence down. Basically, he was like, this could work if we make it middle grade, but like, I, you know, like make it in the category of Harry Potter instead of kind of feeling more teen or older. And at that time, I just couldn't see how to do it. I didn't know how to change the one into the other because it was so firmly fixed in my mind. But kind of interestingly, it was the exact same feedback that I got from Simon and Schuster. And when I finally did that work that Chris had initially requested, that was how the book did get published. And so, I mean, I think his eye was right on. But to me at that time, what seemed more doable for my brain was to just make something new. And I was like, okay, you want something with a young main character. And I'd had this short story idea of a secret wildlife park for magical creatures that was coming to life in my head. I was like, well, why don't I pitch this? Because the pitch seemed good. And it was a very exciting moment for me when I pitched that idea to Chris and I watched him kind of light up. Like it seemed like he really saw potential there. And I'd never once had a publisher give me now that might be what we're looking for. I'd never heard words like that. And so for me, it lit a huge fire under me and I started charging really hard to write that book.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think it took you 4 or 5 months to submit a first full draft of the manuscript. And I chuckled at the title that you had. Obviously you knew it wasn't going to be the final title, but you had to call it something. And it was something like,
Grandpa's Conservancy for Abnormal Flora and Fauna or something like that.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And kind of like rolls off the tongue like Fablehaven, right?
Yeah. I was so stymied that I was like, I'll do a horrible title and that'll be better than any sincere attempt.
That original manuscript is under glass right now. If you go downtown to the city center
in Salt Lake City,
outside of the Desert Book, retail store there on South Temple, you'll see it's just under glass, just with a notation that this was the original manuscript. I think it's next to the John Stockton biography with his signed basketball and I can't remember
what some other book memorabilia.
I feel like we should take that out. Now people are going to hear this and think, oh my gosh,
it's valuable.
There it is. Yeah.
There's going to be a heist.
Smash and grab. Yeah.
Tell me,
luck selling that on the open market.
Right? Yeah. Talk to me about the significance, for Fablehaven and Shadow Mountain. Cause there's a big thing that happened with that book.
Yeah. You roll the dice. Every publisher rolls the dice with every book you publish. People always ask me, what do you do for a living? And basically I'm a gambler. because you do, you roll the dice, you don't know, you hope and you think with your best, you know, with the hopefully good judgment that you have that something that you publish will sell well. And this immediately connected, right? I think right out of the chute, you know, it had sold enough copies to get people's attention. And, so much so that, that's how a partnership began with Simon & Schuster and Aladdin. And they saw what we were doing and they, asked if the paperback rights were available. And at that time I thought, you know, I think it would be a good thing to have two publishers supporting Brandon,
right,
rather than just us, you know, one publisher. And to Simon Schuster's credit and Aladdin, you know, they saw the worth, right, of this IP and put the resources behind it. And it really, you know, took off and it really has become a mainstay, you know, for Shadow Mountain year after year. Any chance I get, I'll go back to the Shadow Mountain or the Fable Haven well, right? And okay, what else could we create Fable Haven wise that will get fans excited again, you know, for this world that Brandon has created that has really just sunk deep into the souls of so many readers. I can't tell you how many parents and librarians and children's literary advocates who have reached out and said, Fable Haven was the book that got my son or daughter to start reading, period. Yeah. Right. I mean, over and over, Brandon hears this all the time at book signings. And there's something about the world he created that really, opened young minds up to making it feel like it wasn't a chore, right? It all of a sudden became real and something that really touched them on a personal level.
Now I know Shadow Mountain is not the big dog in the world of publishing, right? It's a small publishing house. Brandon has told me though that you guys do some things better than any publishers in the world, with marketing and the attention that you give to that. Brandon, what's been your experience working with, and this podcast isn't to like compare Simon & Schuster to Shadow Mountain, who's better and best, but there are skills and there are, emphasis that you guys place on books that Brandon doesn't get anywhere else.
Yeah. Every place has their strengths and weaknesses. And some of Shadow Mountain's strengths are that they, the books they do, they give a lot of attention. Sometimes I think at a big publisher, there's a generic marketing package that a lot of the books get. And I'm sure some of that happens for Shadow Mountain as well, in that not every book is going to get the same level of attention. That's just inherent to living in a world with limited resources, right? But like at Shadow Mountain, I really think a big part of their competitive advantage is Chris's own creativity. And the fact that he tries to think up events and marketing stunts and marketing plans that suit and fit each author and book. He's very personally involved. And so what I get at Shadow Mountain is a lot of individualized attention and effort. And then I get like really smart, effective grassroots marketing, which isn't always the strength of some of the big publishers. And some of the strength that the big publishers bring, they might have more marketing contacts or more channels or more clout in the national marketplace. But that doesn't always come with the same amount of attention and effort. And I think, I don't know, for me, in my experience, I've been doing this about 20 years. Those are some of the differences I perceive.
Yeah. Chris, when you think about your career and what you do as a publisher, I know you're joking around saying I'm a gambler. What do you do as a publisher though? And what is kind of the nuts and bolts everyday life of a publisher? What does that look like?
Yeah. The number one responsibility that I have is making sure I have the right lineup year after year, right? Because content is king, mm-hmm, for any publisher. If you don't have the right content, you literally live or die by content. And so, making sure we have the right brands, acquiring the talent that, will get us the sales we need, in any given year. So that is my number one, my priority. I mean, I have a group of, editors that are also, you know, reaching out, looking for talent. But, I mean, we have a, and then I have a marketing team and a sales manager, and I mean, and I try to stay out of their way for the most part, but I can't help like my first love and really the skill that I think I have always shined at is, promotion and marketing. So there are some titles and some brands that even though publishers don't typically get involved in such a minute level, like I will always do that for any like brand and own title, for example, just because, you know, Fablehaven was one of those first true loves, you know, that was so fun to work at and to see the reaction from the audience.
Yeah. I think, some of our audience, members are all aspiring writers, right? Wanting to get sure. and trying to figure out how this whole publishing thing works and what's the best way to, I guess, get your attention? What's the best way to do it? And what does it look like from your perspective? I think it would be nice for them to hear, like, you know, my acquisition team's reading this many manuscripts a week or a month or something. And why, because I think there's a sense of my manuscript's not even getting read fully or getting any attention, or I'm not getting responses from publishers. What, from your point of view, what does it look like?
Yeah. I mean, the larger publishers are getting thousands of manuscripts, right? I mean, we're not that large, but we're still getting hundreds of manuscripts every year. And so I do have an acquisitions team that is reviewing things. They kind of know what we're looking for. They know the content that has to be there, right? Or the content that should not be there. And so we meet on a weekly basis, right? I have an editorial meeting that I attend with my editors every week, and we review any manuscripts that have come in that have caught our eye. Or someone's eye within the editorial team, and we'll talk about them. And in that process, you know, the thing is every publisher is looking for that diamond in the rough,
right?
Right. We need writers. Every publisher needs writers. We're looking for writers, desperately looking every week, you know, to find someone that that can be a new IP for us. And so, and yet rejection is just simply part of the process. Right. And so my advice to any writer who wants to catch the eye of a publisher is, number one, do your homework, know what you're pitching, and know who you're pitching to. Right. And to know that, rejection is part of the process. I always tell writers to, eject the reject, mm-hmm. Right. It's just part of the process. I always, carry around my three favorite rejection letters. And do you mind if I share these?
No, go, please.
Because I think these are...
These are rejection letters that...
These are just rejection letters that I found online. Okay. You may have heard before, but these are from very, very famous authors, right? Who... And you may have heard these, but the Little Christopher Agency receives 12 publishing rejections in a row for their new client until the 8-year-old daughter of a Bloomsbury editor demands to read the rest of the book. The editor agrees to publish, but advises the writer to get a day job since she has little chance of making money in children's books. Yet Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling spawns a series where the last 4 novels consecutively set records as the fastest selling books in history on both sides of the Atlantic with combined sales of 450 million. This was published a few years ago, weren't you? But still, you get the idea.
Yeah, she should have gone on and got a day job for sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. This one,
her day job is counting money.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one I love. The editor who rejected it says about this, she says, the girl doesn't, it seems to me, have a special perception or feeling which would lift that book above the curiosity level, end of quote. Perhaps the most misguided literary critique in history, with a further 15 rejections, there remained little hope for her personal thoughts. There remained little hope her personal thoughts would see the light of day. Eventually, Doubleday brings the translation to the world, and the Diary of Anne Frank sells 25 million copies. right? I mean, those are the things that that writers have to remember. Like, these, you know, editors don't know everything,
right?
Right? Not even close, right? They're using their own, you know, formula, bias, whatever, you know, likes, dislikes. It's so subjective. And so just because you get a rejection means nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear this over and over and over again. And then my most favorite is the one line that this editor said as part of the rejection was, "Too different from other juveniles on the market to warrant its selling." A rejection letter sent to Dr. Seuss. 300 million sales and the 9th best-selling fiction author of all time.
How much fear do you have that you have rejected a Harry Potter or something like that?
Oh, yeah. I have rejected things that have gone on to sell well, right? And sometimes just simply... Well, we just, like, especially for small publishers, right? We just brought in a book similar to that, mm-hmm. right? So we're going to put our resources, time, and energy into that,
right?
And we're going to have to let this one go. Mm-hmm. You always hope you don't miss, you know, that diamond. But no publisher gets it right all the time. Just zero chance. I remember... our publishing house rejected, this is while I was still in the marketing department. So I feel like I have to wipe my brow a little bit because I wasn't in the publisher's chair, but there was this little book called The Christmas Box that, you know, came to our publisher and we rejected
Richard Paul Evans.
Richard Paul Evans, and bless his heart and good for him. Couldn't be happy for him.
Sold tons and tons and tons.
Yeah. Millions and millions of copies. Right. And so
I've done some videos for their foundation as well. And they have a great organization and it's awesome that they're doing the charity work that they're doing on top of what they do.
The success and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, 100%.
That's a good example. That's one where like, if you could have it back, you'd be like, oh, that might've been nice to be in on that. Right.
Yeah. So here are the four areas, that I hope writers are really looking out before submitting to a publisher.
Good.
And it's an acronym that I use, right? And this is something I created, I made up. It doesn't work for everybody, but it's what I use. And it's an acronym called, it's PAID, paid, right? In essence, because I have to remember, I'm a for-profit company. I have to get paid,
right?
And so any pitch that comes in to me is like a resume, right? The resume comes in and I have to decide, do I want to hire this person? Right. To help me make money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so the P is for a polished pitch, right? Is it well written? And that may seem, well, duh, like, of course it's going to be, well, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, just please, the thing I would ask is, you know, get involved in the writing group, right? Get beta readers that you trust, right? That give you that can help you polish. Right.
And remember that your pitch is also a writing sample.
Yes.
So show off with your good writing in your pitch, right?
Yeah.
Be engaging, be interesting, be succinct.
Yeah. And usually, you know, an editor, an agency, an agent, will ask for, I don't know, the first 10 pages or the first chapter. It just varies depending on what you're sending in. And so you just have to make sure that first glimpse is really going to provide an impact. The A stands for appropriate. And what I mean by there is, are the themes valid to our publishing house? Right. You know, every publisher, has a mission. And I mean, we have a specific mission statement, right. And we're looking for things that can, inspire greatness and strengthen families and promote virtue and build faith and motivate service. Those are the types of things that I'm looking for. Doesn't mean they have to include all those things, mm-hmm. right? But they have to include at least one of them.
And they shouldn't be going contrary to any of those things.
Right. Yes, very true. Yeah, yeah. So, and I love that, you know, Brandon's titles there are so many of those things in Brandon's titles, if not all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might not think, you know, can a dragon promote faith? Actually, yeah. Like if you read between the lines, like there are so many awesome gospel messages, you know, in some of those, conversations. I love it. The I is for innovative, and is the plot or idea fresh? And boy, that's the key thing that every publisher is looking for, right? What differentiates your book from all the other books that are in this same category? And that's not an easy thing to do. That, you know, it's that idea, that golden nugget that every writer is trying to find and every publisher wants to receive.
Yeah. If you can clearly state in your pitch what differentiates your book from other books in a category that gets read and has an audience, you have given the publisher how to market the book,
yeah,
which answers that paid question. How do I make money off this?
Yeah. Yeah. And the last letter as part of the acronym of PAID is dependable. And what I mean by that is, what are the dependable comp titles? Does it have a proven audience? Right. I mean, because most publishers will want to know what your comp titles are. I'm not saying every editor or agent wants to know that, but many do. And, if I know that, your manuscript is for the same audience that these other titles have done well. Most agents and publishers use what's called a book scan, which is a, kind of a metadata service that allows, publishers to know, the sales of any title that's ever been published. Mm. Right. And I would say it's not all sales, but it's probably close to 80% of sales that have come through reporting bookstores. And that also includes Amazon and all the key retailers. And so it's an easy tool that we use that we can say, oh, okay, these are some of the comp titles. And when I say comp titles, I don't mean Harry Potter.
Right.
Right. If you're a debut author, then show me comp titles from debut authors.
Gotcha.
Right. That would, you know, catch my attention and it would impress me, you know? And so that's what I mean by doing your homework.
That's interesting. I was thinking about those rejection letters and you pick three doozies, right? But I was also thinking, what would have happened if one of those publishers picked up those authors without the vision and believing in the project, right? Would they have had the success? And so sometimes when you look at a rejection letter from a publisher, you should probably go, this isn't a good fit. I need somebody to publish my book that sees the vision.
Absolutely.
Of this book, who believes in this book and wants to be a part of this thing. And it's okay for a publisher and an author not to be a good fit for each other. And it doesn't mean that the publisher is bad, and it doesn't mean the book is bad. It means that relationship, it may not be perfect.
I remember going to, I know Shannon Hale has been on one of your podcasts. And I remember, I went to a workshop I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember she was talking about rejection letters, and she had this roll, and she rolls it out down the hall, and it just rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls. And it's kind of hard to believe that someone like Shannon Hale would have ever gotten a rejection letter. I mean, how is that possible?
Yeah. Very gifted with language, has had a ton of success.
Yeah. And yet she wore it as a badge of honor. You know, and that's what writers should look at it as,
yeah.
You know, like, oh, and they should be glad that it was rejected by an agent or an editor that wasn't, as you said, just in love with it.
Yeah.
Right. If you don't see if I'm not passionate about something, yeah, you don't want me as your publisher.
Yeah. I've really learned this in the entertainment world, that without an impassioned advocate inside the organization you're working with, your stuff gets lost. And so, like, part of why Fablehaven was successful and has been successful and has had continued titles is that Chris likes it. Like, to him, the books are cool and worth sharing. And if there wasn't somebody with that vision at Shadow Mountain, all that stuff doesn't happen. And that's been the same when I tried to sell film rights. You know, like, if I ever sold film rights and there wasn't a face to it, there wasn't a person who is impassioned about it, those never went anywhere.
Yeah.
It always takes somebody who actually cares and actually likes it. And so in a way, when you're submitting your books to get published, or when you're submitting your books to an agent, it's more comparable to dating. You're not just trying to find somebody or a warm body. You're trying to find the right fit.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a, this is a personal story of a friend of mine. I won't give names, but, he was dating who would become his wife. And, she asked him one day, do you love me? And he's like, I don't know. And her response was that to that was, I deserve to be loved. Right. And like, if we're going to have a relationship, it's going to be a relationship where you love me. Right. Or we don't have a relationship. Right.
Right.
And I think it's the same thing with a publisher and an author, right. They have to have that level of love for the work that they're doing. And,
or at least that's the ideal thing for any magic to happen.
I truly feel honored and blessed to have had a almost 20-year career with Brandon. Like it's a rare thing for a publisher to have that kind of career. Brandon has been so loyal to Shadow Mountain. And you might think, well, wait, doesn't he publish with other publishers?
Isn't he stepping out on you?
From time to time.
And the fact is,
he's got a publisher on the side. It's not
flavor of the year kind of thing.
I love that Brandon has other publishers because they're pumping resources and money into his brand. Uh-huh. Right.
Right.
And which only means that what I do is going to sell more.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, it's a win-win.
As long as they're doing good work, it's helping grow the pie for everyone.
And it shows what you can do as Shadow Mountain for him. The fact that Brandon will still come back to the Shadow Mountain relationship.
Yeah. And so Brandon has been such a good author. And I think you may not remember this, Brandon, but we had one argument that kind of made me take a step back and think I could handle that better. And you probably don't remember what it was, but I'll tell you.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it was, I don't know. It was like I'm trying to remember what book it was in the Dragon Watch series. It might've been book 4, maybe it was 5, where you kind of told me kind of the length of it. And I was like, okay, well, I only budgeted for this many pages, so you're going to have to cut it. And I remember the look you gave me. It was like daggers coming out of your eyes. Like you, and I thought, oh boy, I crossed the line here. Like, and the fact of the matter is, I mean, Brandon has sold. I mean, you know, he's made.
He's worth the extra 50 pages on a book.
I mean, you know, you get set. I mean, every publisher has their weaknesses, right? I got set in my formula, right? And I had to step back and say, okay, Chris, if he wanted to add 200 more pages, why would you care?
Yeah.
Like, because you're going to sell just as many books, if you know, maybe you'll sell more because people will be curious. Well, why did Brandon write so many more books, so many pages? And so, and I said, you know what? I apologize. You're right. Like, write as much as you want.
Right? That is really funny, Chris. Here's the thing. If they're bad pages, that's a different conversation.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like if you're saying, hey, some of this stuff doesn't work, that's a different conversation.
That's like much different than I budgeted
But I'm like, dude, this is my finale book. I've got a big grand thing planned for you. Like, just let me do that. And if it's, hey, if the work is bad, tell me that. But let's not limit it beforehand. You know?
No, you taught me a valuable lesson, you know, even as, you know, as long as I've been doing this, that sometimes the publisher has to listen to the author, right? It has to trust the author that they know the story. They know they have the vision for this. And Brandon says, as long as it's not, I mean, honestly, Brandon, your brain isn't capable of allowing you to write bad pages. He would self-edit that.
Right.
Right. And if he didn't, Erlin would. Yeah. Right. And so
hopefully at least truly lousy stuff, but I, as a little asterisk, there's always so much help I get from my publisher and my editors. I know that I'm not like creating magic on every first draft, but I hope I would censor myself on something lousy at least.
I have to do a little shout out here because Brandon's first drafts all of a sudden became better first drafts when Erlin started to become his first draft editor, right? I would get a first draft and like, oh, this is a lot cleaner than it usually is.
Well, we did record an episode with Erlin that will be released by the time this one gets released. But we jumped into that that talent.
Yeah, we just did, like, it would have been last month, yeah. But we just did a thing about editing with Erlin because she has such good insights there.
Yeah, 100%.
So, Chris, I'm going to ask you to be a little bit vulnerable here. You sent me a manuscript a couple years ago on a book that you wrote. And I think a lot of people think, oh, just because Chris is a publisher, he can publish anything that he writes. Do you want to talk to me about your experience writing a book?
And yeah, that was actually a book that my son and I had sort of worked on together. It was really his brainchild. And I loved that he invited me to come and sort of help co-write. Even though he wrote the first draft, I wanted to show him my love for him and my support for him. And so, and that's still in the process, right? I mean, it's back in his court, but I, you know, I wanted, yeah, I sent it to a bunch of different beta readers trying to get, this is another testament of the importance of just getting good feedback on anything you write before you send it out. Right. And I remember the feedback that you gave us, and I sent it to my son, and again, it was eye-opening, you know, like, oh, this isn't ready.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard to see the forest for the trees, even in a position that I was in, right, as a writer.
Right.
Right. And so, you can't do it alone.
Yeah.
That's what I guess I'm getting at.
I'm working on a very similar project where my son and I are working on a book together where he's doing, I would say, roughly 98% of all the writing and whatnot, but incorporating a story that I'm helping him with. And I had you read the first little bit of that story as well. And it's a fun process to work with your son on a project with that. So it's cool that you two are working on that. And I'm excited to see a future draft of your son's book again.
Yeah.
As I watch Chris, because Chris has a lot of talents, and he really, he writes picture books, he writes novels, he writes all sorts of things. And some of them have been ghostwritten, and some of the stuff he's ghostwritten has sold lots and lots of copies. Like he probably can't talk about some of it, but because he was a ghostwriter. But like, one of the things I see with him is he's so hesitant to publish himself. Like I think he is his own harshest critic when it comes to, like, will he take his publishing position and use it to publish his own work, very infrequently. And if so, kind of quietly, like he does it very modestly and quietly. And to me, he could be so much more open about it if he wanted to, because he does really good work. But it shows me that he takes that position of responsibility as a gatekeeper really carefully. Is that pretty true, Chris?
Yeah, for 100%. Like, I think someday when I retire, I will, and maybe I'm more free, right? Which I'm really excited about. You know, I think there will come a day when I retire, I will write full time. I'm excited for that and looking forward to that day.
And I'm looking forward to it with fear, because
in competition.
No, not because of the competition. Because when he's retired, he's not guy marketing my book, and that'll be a dark day for me, because he's really helped my career a lot.
Yeah. I think last year you pitched a project to Brandon that he ran with. You want to tell me a little bit about that pitch and where that came from? And
again, it's always, you know, going back to that Fablehaven well. Mm-hmm. You know, what could we create that would interest Brandon's core Fablehaven fans? And so,
and as an asterisk to this, before you say it, I should say that for the Fablehaven reader who likes some of the ancillary books, like The Caretaker's Guide to Fablehaven, or The Adventurer's Guide to Dragonwatch, or The Fablehaven Book of Imagination, some of these books that are companion books to the series, so many of these are coming from Chris's ideas and Chris's efforts. If he wasn't passionate about the brand, I'm not sure I would have run with those ideas and made them happen. But it's a lot of his creativity and his interest in the brand and his appreciation of the brand is what helps a lot of that stuff happen. So this is just me trying to give credit where credit's due. Mm,
you're kind. So one of the, two of the favorite characters in Fablehaven are the comedic satyrs, Newell and Doran, right? They have always been two of my favorite characters. And I think whenever they take center stage in any of the pages of Brandon's novels, they steal the show. Right, and, right. I love how he's been able to do that. So I thought, you know, what if like, there were stories about Newell and Doran, you know, that follow them, right? As the heroes, which is so unlike Newell and Doran, and
right.
mm-hmm. you know, because they're typically the opposite of heroes.
They're so irresponsible.
Yeah. And so just pitching that idea to Brandon, I think he mulled it over for a while, and then which he always does with any idea I pitch him, and then when it surfaces, he realizes maybe there's something there, you know. And it didn't take him long to write this this book, which is set up to be a potential series, even though the first book is a standalone. Right, it's called The Tales of Newell and Doran. And, you know, the first book is this first tale
right.
of, you know, that starts and then finishes that tale.
Yeah. Gorgon's Fury.
That's awesome. Brandon, do you remember after he pitched this to you, what was the thing that finally hooked for you where you went, oh, I see it. I get it. I can make a story out of this. What was that? What was that moment?
Yeah, I can tell you. Like, yeah, I know exactly. In my mind, the thing that made it make sense for me was in Fablehaven, one of the rules of magic and one of the rules of like just the way the story world works is magic is not for mortals. The mortals, when they do magic, it has to be with resources somehow borrowed from the magical creatures whose nature is magical. But there's a converse law to that where change, evolution, personal change is for mortals, is something that mortals are good at, that magical creatures are not good at. In Fablehaven, most of the magical creatures kind of stay in their state unless acted upon by mortals. And so as I realized that Newell and Doran had been so incredibly frivolous at the start of the series, but after being acted upon by mortals, they had developed some aspects of responsibility and caring. And without those, I don't think they would be that interesting to follow. But the fact that they had evolved into something sort of like adolescence, learning to be a little more responsible and learning to care a little more, to me, that felt like a journey that would be fun to follow. What does it look like as these satyrs kind of wake up into being more responsible or perhaps even occasionally heroic? Because they have their heroic moments in Fablehaven and in Dragonwatch. But it was like, oh, what if we get to watch them grow into more responsible beings? And to me, it even fits the audience, because the audience of these books, the prime audience is kids and teens growing up. And here you have these satyrs who are ancient chronologically, but they are adolescents emotionally.
Right.
And so this really is a story about kids, the childhood of these satyrs kind of ending as they grow into being more responsible. And to me, suddenly that was fun and interesting. And there was a lot to talk about.
Can you just real quick, how do you tell the difference between the two, and which one did you pick to be the protagonist in this book and why?
Yeah, so that's kind of tricky because Newell and Doran, we'd never really fully explained their relationship. Are they brothers? Are they friends? I finally nailed it down in this new book. And so we're saying Newell and Doran are cousins. And I don't think in the Fablehaven books we ever identified that. And if I did, sorry, I forgot.
or if they were twin brothers and now they're not.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure we knew they were at least best friends. We knew they might be brothers or something, but we never got into it. But so you have these cousins who are so similar, but the thing that I kind of liked in my head, Newell was always a little bit more impulsive, a little bit more pushy, and Doran was a little bit more grounded and a little bit more restrained. And so I thought, yeah, let's make the impulsive one the point of view character. And but we'll feel like we're inhabiting both of them because they're always together so much.
Very cool. Well, Chris, anything you want to pitch as we close up here?
Yeah, I guess, again, one of the other things that I look for, and it goes along with this, with one of my favorite quotes from children's author, Kate DiCamillo, who, you know, who's just, very prolific, very successful. And she says, quote, "Stories are light and light is precious in a world so dark." And it also reminds me of when our corporate offices were dedicated, it was, President Henry B. Eyring said this during the dedication. He said, quote, "The moral darkness which seems to increase in the world is your opportunity. Whatever offers light will be to the discerning eye more and more attractive," end of quote. And so the thing that attracts me most in the stories that I receive is the light that I can find within the story. Brandon Mole knows how to write light. He does it so well, and it's so almost imperceptible, but yet it seeps down into our very core. And I believe that's why he's so successful, is because we feel that light, right? We not only feel it, but we thrive on it. And so if you're looking to pitch something to me as a publisher, again, every publisher is different, but if your character is a character that shines light, right? That is an empathy building character, is one that is compassionate and one that can bring light to others. And even a dragon can bring light, right? Like it's all depends on the character.
Right. And that light can look so many different ways. That light can come through as humor and that light can come through as goodness, or that light can come through as trying to make a hard choice, but making the right choice in really hard circumstances. All these things can feel like light. And even if the story has a lot of darkness in it, sometimes that can make the light shine brighter depending on how you handle it.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you for being here today. I just wanted to tell you something that Brandon told me once about you. And that was that people outside of this market in New York were very well aware of you and were actively trying to steal you away,
to recruit him,
recruit you to bigger markets and things. And he just mentioned how you have found a home here that is more than just about, you know, endless amount of publishing dollars and stuff. But I love that you reflect the light that you're trying to find as well. And so, I think it speaks to your integrity and the success that you've had here in this market. So
thanks so much, Jason. And thanks, Brandon, for inviting me to be on the podcast. I am an avid listener and, love what you're doing.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm sure this won't be your last episode with us. So we're excited to have you back one day, but, thanks for being here today and mulling it over with Brandon Mole.
Fellow adventurers, I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.